Welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations Africa in Transition podcast. I am John Campbell, and I'm here with Jeffrey Gettleman, 2012 Pulitzer Prize winner, and the New York Times East Africa Bureau Chief. Jeffrey is the author of Love Africa, a book that documents his past decade working in sub-Saharan Africa. To start, could you tell us what prompted you to write this book?
Yeah, a few things prompted me. One was having a midlife crisis and reaching my early 40s and wanting to do something a little different. But more so, I feel frustrated at times that I present one side of Africa, more or less. I focus on conflict in my job at the New York Times. I find myself getting drawn into these war zones and very difficult situations in Somalia, in Central African Republic, in South Sudan, in Eastern Congo. So much of my work is concentrated on conflicts, injustices, human rights abuse, because I feel that that's a big part of my responsibility, is to shed some light on these problems. And that's what hard news is. It's about disasters and dramatic events. So I wanted to show another side of the region. And I'm very attached to East Africa. I came there when I was young, 18 years old, and I fell in love with that part of the world. And I still am in love with that part of the world and still really appreciate the spirit and the values and the connection between people. And I wanted to show in this book that there are these two sides. And one of the sides gets very de-emphasized in the news, the positives, the sense of hope, that spirit. So that was my mission in this book. And finally, to open a window on that part of the world that a lot of people feel very disconnected from. Your audience will be different, but many people in America don't feel like Africa really matters. They've never been there. They don't know anybody who's been there. They don't know much about the region. And so I wanted to tell a personal story that would invite people into that part of the world. Those were my goals.
So it's a way to introduce to an American audience a part of the world that most Americans know very little about, and where the media attention is mostly on violence of one form or another. And the book reflects the fact that you have developed a deep affection for East Africa. Have I got that right?
You put it really well. You should do this more often.
Well, there's a certain parallel between your reaction and mine. I, too, fell in love, in my case, with West Africa. And again, in my case, I was about 20 years older than you were when you fell in love with Africa. So I can understand that. I can relate to that very well. In your position as bureau chief for the Times in East Africa, how do you decide, or how do your editors decide, what to write about?
So that's like the hardest part of the job, because I cover, as the East Africa bureau chief, 13 countries, about 400 million people, over a territory the size of the continental United States. And it's just me. I have a small support staff of Kenyans who help me, but I am the sole writer and the one in charge of the news from all those different places that are very different from each other and produce lots of news that we should be watching. So it's hard. Every day I sit down at my computer in my office in Nairobi, and I start looking at websites from around the region. I start looking at the wire services that are covering the news. And I look at local newspapers that are covering the news in individual countries. And there's just so much flying at me. On any given day, there could be a huge wildlife story brewing in Kenya, a conflict brewing in eastern Congo over minerals, famine issues, urgent famine issues in Somalia, political problems in South Sudan, and so on and so on. So this is like the hardest part of the job. The way I look at it is I want to get the biggest bang for my buck. I carry a big megaphone. I carry this big megaphone that says the New York Times on it.
That's right.
And I want to use that responsibly. So I tend to focus on stories that are trying to shed some light on a problem or an issue that is not getting a lot of attention. And that if I write about it in a compelling way, maybe there will be some positive change. So I actually won the Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for writing about the Somali famine back then.
Right.
There was a famine. And it was at a time when the Arab world was on fire. That was the same year as the Arab Spring. But nobody was really looking at Somalia. And there were millions of lives hanging in the balance because of the Shabab terrorist group blocking food aid and because of a drought that was sweeping across the country. And I felt like if I could do my job and cast a little light on that problem, maybe aid organizations would be more inclined to respond. Maybe policymakers in Washington and other parts of the world that read the New York Times would be more interested. So that's an example of just trying to pick my shot carefully and do stories with high impact. But the problem is, and this is why I wanted to expand on this in the book, and also write about my own inner turmoil and conflict about this, is that if you do that, you're writing a lot of hard-hitting stories about misery and violence, because that's what you feel like people should know about in the hopes of help coming. And there are other aspects of life in East Africa, music, technology, sports, economic growth, that often get downplayed in this quest to do these big investigative pieces about very important dramatic issues. So it's a balance, because you don't want to misrepresent the region. But at the same time, I have a responsibility to do the hardest hitting pieces I can do. And that often involves conflict.
Well, that's right. But you're absolutely right about whole wide areas being overlooked. I'm particularly interested in the fine arts. There's some absolutely magnificent painting being done in Nigeria, which is hardly exhibited here at all. Can you tell us what you're working on right now?
Yeah. So right now I'm working on a big piece about land in Africa, which is a very interesting topic that cuts across many different issues. So Africa is going to face a big land crisis because the population in sub-Saharan Africa is growing faster than anywhere in the world. If you look at population charts, the Africa projections are a steep curve, whereas China's population is actually going to decrease in coming years because of the one-child policy. And Europe and then North America's population is leveling off and may even decrease in some countries.
Mm-hmm.
Africa is going the opposite direction. There are projections that there are going to be 4 billion Africans by the end of the century. And how this connects to land is this. 70 to 80% of Africans depend on agriculture and land for their livelihood. Africa is a continent of agriculture. There are a few industrial areas in sub-Saharan Africa, but they're tiny compared to the vast expanse of rural Africa that's undeveloped and people live off the land. And so what we're going to see is this increased pressure on land because of the population growth. And at the same time, the quality of the land in many areas is actually getting worse. Climate change is turning areas that were just on the edge of arable and semi-arid into arid areas. And there are millions of people that live in places right now that are soon going to be deserts. And there's also just problems with overuse, where you have many people farming, and they need that land, they need to produce food, and that's sucking nutrients out of the soil. So we're going to see conflicts across the continent. This may actually be a new axis of conflict. It's beginning now. For instance, in Nigeria, there are herders, Fulani herders, coming from the north, pushing south, and rubbing up against farmers and areas that used to be just pure farming areas. And there's conflict between the groups. You're seeing this across Eastern Africa as well. And you're seeing pressures on land even in urban areas. It's really interesting. Like in Nairobi, I did a story a couple years ago about a playground next to a school. And there was a school in central Nairobi that had this nice playground where the kids would play at recess on swings and run around and play soccer. And one day the police showed up and said, "We're taking this playground because somebody wants to build a hotel." And everybody was mystified, thinking, wait a second, this is government property. It's a playground. Who's taking it? And it emerged that it was Kenya's vice president who had done this underhanded deal to seize the land and develop it into a hotel.
Yes.
And it was only prevented from happening because some activists organized these children to protest, and the police actually tear gassed these kids. And there was video and images of these passed out little girls and other kids weeping from tear gas,
yes,
trying to protect their playground, and that shamed these politicians into backing down. But part of it is the land is getting so valuable. There's been so much economic growth that every piece, every inch of decent land in these countries is becoming increasingly valuable. So that's kind of a segue into sort of two storylines I'm seeing and that you will be familiar with. On one hand, we have rapid economic growth and development in many parts of Africa, in urban areas like Nairobi, like Lagos, even like Kinshasa and DRC. That's happening. The progress is rapid and dramatic. New bridges, new hotels, new airports, new ports, new shops, new malls. It's like, you know, Nairobi, where I live, is like one giant construction site. But at the same time, you have conflicts in some African countries that are as hopeless and difficult to solve as any have ever been. South Sudan is hitting the bottom with thousands of people killing each other in this ethnic bloodletting that has no end. Central African Republic is one of the most neglected countries on the planet, and it has this religious conflict that's claimed thousands of lives and almost nobody knows about it. Somalia is still stuck in this rut of famine and Islamic militancy. Libya is a state in collapse. And so you have these two storylines. They're happening at the same time. You know, dramatic growth, progress, hope in some urban areas, while at the same time you have these enduring conflicts that are very difficult to solve.
It is absolutely fascinating. There are also areas that we tend to overlook where Africa and Africans have an impact, a direct impact on us. For example, Nigeria is now a major exporter of Christian clergy to the United States and to Europe. Lots and lots of ways in which Africa is not nearly as marginal to us as we tend to think.
I totally agree. And just like with resources, so you look at Congo. The Democratic Republic of Congo is the biggest country in sub-Saharan Africa geographically. It is one of the richest countries on the planet in terms of natural resources. There's oil, there's timber, there's gold, diamonds, these new minerals like coltan and cobalt that are used in electronics. And that country remains one of the poorest countries on the planet, because it's been so mismanaged and poorly governed. And that's what I see. I see the biggest problem in Africa isn't poverty per se, isn't education per se, it's leadership. And so many of these countries are trapped in these cycles of poverty and conflict because their leaders are completely disconnected from the people and unaccountable and corrupt and often malevolent. And they are trapping millions of Africans in these desperate circumstances. And it has to do with democracy. It has to do with the colonial legacy. It has to do with the impacts of the Cold War that left many of these countries in without a tradition of a strong nation state. And so many people don't identify with the state. And the leaders are allowed to kind of float above the populations because there was never really a commitment to building institutions. And the Cold War fed into that. During the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union supported very bad leaders across the continent just because those leaders were doing our bidding and were our allies. And when the Cold War ended, many of those countries tipped into chaos. Congo, Rwanda, Somalia, Sierra Leone, Liberia. You saw it in the 90s. It was one of the most violent decades ever. And so that legacy is still playing out. And I think that goes back to the connection. We caused many of these problems across the continent, or we are responsible in some way for the state of the continent today. The West is. And so we have a responsibility to help.
I quite agree. If you can get the leadership right, there are any number of paths towards economic and social development. The problem, is getting the leadership right. With decent leadership, you can then embark on institution building. I am fascinated by the way in South Africa, while at present the Zuma administration appears to be mired in corruption, and yet the institutions that have been established there since the transition to non-racial democracy are strong enough to carry the country forward. One can only hope that this will become a general pattern in Africa.
Well, let me just add, and I totally agree, I agree with you. Kenya is a good example of this push and pull. So you see the executive branch, the president and his inner circle, doing things in Kenya, like trying to take a playground away,
right,
from school children. And there are checks on them, either through civil society or the judiciary, who are in this constant battle to sort of keep those institutions alive and strong. There was an incident a couple of years ago where the Kenyan government said that they were going to, just hire 10,000 police officers, through their own channels to put police officers on the street to fight terrorism. And it was going to be done in a very sort of illegal, insider way, a patronage network, basically, to give,
yes,
these jobs to certain allies. And the judiciary blocked it. They said, no, there's a specific way we're supposed to make these hires, and you have to follow the law. And that may not sound like a big deal, but it actually was, because it was checking the president in a very public way. And that almost is unheard of in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's really interesting to be on the front lines and see that push and pull. And places like Kenya and South Africa, they have that. They have that middle class, that professional class, that they know what's right, and they know what the ingredients are for a stable, productive, prosperous society. But they are constantly in battle with these leadership classes that are trying to kind of pull the wool over the public's eyes. And this happens, corruption is not unique to Africa. We all know that. But it's harder in Africa because those institutions are newer and younger, and not as experienced as they are in the West, where we've had a free press for hundreds of years. That's not true in most of sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, in both Kenya and in South Africa, you also have very strong civil society. Your story about the playground is a nice example of how civil society mobilized can force a vice president to back down.
Exactly. And it was like really discouraging on one hand that would even be attempted, that, somebody would. It was basically like a militia. The vice president was sending these police officers under his own command, outside the channels of the police department, and doing it for commercial gain at the expense of relatively poor school kids.
Sure. Oh, sure.
But it was inspiring that there was, that people pushed back and that they won.
And in South Africa, it's an absolutely free press combined with a strong and assertive judiciary that is playing such an important role.
And I am hopeful for South Africa long term, but I think that it's at a very touchy, shaky point right now.
Oh, it is. I agree.
And I think there's deep social tensions in South Africa that are part of its DNA, sadly.
Yes.
And that there's going to be a reckoning. There's going to be some turmoil. That's my prediction. Just going to South Africa and talking to people across all sort of socioeconomic strata, nobody feels good about the future. You know, rich whites or rich blacks are worried. You know, poor blacks are worried.
Mm-hmm.
They think that the sort of leadership is increasingly disconnected. So I think the institutions will hold that country together. I don't think there will be a civil war or massive bloodshed or anything like that. But I do predict some social turmoil over the next few years. And the ANC will probably split. That would be my prediction.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, I think it's the process of splitting now.
And it needs that, because right now it's almost a one-party state.
Right.
And it needs a competitive electoral system that then there will be more incentive to respond to the public's needs.
And then in Kenya, there's a challenge of upcoming elections.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, Kenya is so good at so many things. It's got a wonderful tourism industry. It's got impressive financial services. Kenyans invented mobile money.
I know, yes.
Right now in Kenya, so many people go to the grocery store, and instead of reaching into their wallets, they pull out their phone and they pay the cashier through a text message, taking money off their phone and giving it to the store.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the direction of the future, and that was invented in Kenya. That wasn't imported technology. Kenyans came up with how to do that and how to spread that and market that. But at the same time, every year there's an election. Every election cycle, the country is paralyzed in fear and tension.
Yes.
And the ethnic, tensions begin to rise. Sporadic violence happens across the country, sometimes leading to major violence. And it's like Kenya, which is one of the more promising countries in sub-Saharan Africa, a beautiful place to live, it just cannot figure out how to have a peaceful election.
Mm-hmm.
or a quiet election. Every time it's really tense.
Mm-hmm.
And we're approaching that. There's an election set in August. And there's a lot of tension, and hopefully it will blow over. But that that prospect of bloodshed is there, and it scares people.
Sure, sure. Now, South Africa is a place that does know how to conduct peaceful elections, and I would suggest that Nigeria is rapidly learning how to do it. The most recent national elections there were, I think, encouraging.
That's true, but Nigeria also has one of the worst insurgencies on the continent.
Oh, it does indeed. It's got three of them.
Yeah. And so it's like here is the economic powerhouse of the continent and soon to be a major nation in the world in terms of population and economic potential. And there are vast spaces of Nigeria that are not controlled by the central government.
Absolutely.
Kidnap 300 girls and just go away. I mean, think in the United States, if one child goes missing in a community, it becomes a major issue.
Does indeed.
With posters of "Have you seen me?" put up on telephone poles and the communities mobilizing to find that one child. 300 girls get kidnapped in Nigeria, and it takes years to track them down.
And the government started paying attention to the Chibok schoolgirls because of agitation in the United States that was taken up by Nigerian civil society. It's that particular aspect of it is discouraging.
I can see that.
We could go on all day, Jeffrey. Africa is so intensely interesting. But I want to thank you for joining us today. And I also want to thank you for the work that you do for the New York Times. The work you do for the New York Times, of course, is work that you do for all of us that read the New York Times. And to our audience, I want to thank you for tuning in today to Africa in Transition.